Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what you see and hear, please make sure to give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to us on. We are everywhere. That way, we can keep doing what we love, and that's talk about a truckload of animation this episode. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host for this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And oh boy, I did not realize until we hit record how packed this episode in particular was. We've got reviews for a Star Wars Studio Ghibli short, Zootopia Plus, the soccer football movie. And then, of course, we've got My Father's Dragon, One Piece Film Red. And guess what, guys? The Ghibli Journey is back, and we're finally covering Porco Rosso. But first, we do have some sad news. On Friday, November 11th, it was reported that we lost Kevin Conroy at the age of 66. This was a huge blow to the entire animation comic book all across the world.
Entertainment media in general, Kevin Conroy was a big name. I mean, I know most people know him as Batman, but he's done like a lot of other things. Then he's also shown up on other projects and such, but of course, most people know him and identify him as the one, the only, the perfect Batman. It was incredibly heartbreaking to hear that. 66 is just way too young for him to be passing on.
Yeah, and of course, cancer just needs to die.
Yeah, cancer just needs to piss off already. We rest in peace, Kevin Conroy. You will be missed. You were a light that brightened everyone's day, and the world of Batman and DC Comics will be different without you.
Well said.
Let's move on to something a little different and something that caught everyone off guard with a slight asterisk next to that surprise. Lucasfilms and Studio Ghibli teamed up to make a 3-minute, or well, technically 2-minute long short called Zen, Grogu and Dust Bunnies, where everyone's favorite little Yoda alien from The Mandalorian encounters one of Studio Ghibli's more iconic characters, the little dust bunnies from My Neighbor Totoro. Though they also look like the soot spirits from Spirited Away, but that's neither here nor there. I wish I could really enjoy this for what it is, because it's cute. It's just a little Zen screensaver thing that you can put on in the background if you wanted to for just a few minutes. Because it's just a little cute animated short of him interacting with the dust bunnies. Only for this announcement to be hampered by the fact that Bob Chapek, one of the worst executives in the entertainment industry, is about to lay off a heck of a lot of people at Disney. Yeah, it sucks that this cool little collaboration is now going to be stuck with the fact that it's tied to some very sad news. And right when the holidays are about to begin, just lordy.
That's the worst part. Sure, it was fun for the previous 2 days of the entire internet speculating, oh, what could this possibly be? Only for it to turn out to be, a pretty cute animation test. That this kind of comes off as Disney jangling the keys at their audience. Well, I don't know if they gave a number, but like anywhere close to like hundreds of employees getting laid off is not something you want to hear.
I hate that we have to be in this defensive stance of like, oh, something new. What's the catch? Because there's always something attached to some of these really cool announcements. It was like that with Netflix when they announced that they were saving that one movie. And then, like, weeks later, they started to cancel everything left and right. And then it's like, oh, we're hearing news about the cool Batwoman movie. Oh, no. The guy in charge of Warner Brothers Discovery hates everything. So he's getting rid of all that. Can we just enjoy something and the artists and animators that are working in this already unforgiving industry a break for 5 minutes for the love of gravy? What sucks, because again, Grogu and Dust Bunnies is super sweet. Even though it's connected to Star Wars, it doesn't really feel like a Star Wars short. It has more of that Ghibli magic than the Star Wars stuff.
Under better circumstances, I would love to just watch this on a loop, or maybe something a bit more substantial with Grogu just having his own little cute adventures. But it's the timing of this that's unfair, but that's just what it is.
And then a few days before that, we got the anthology series Zootopia Plus, which are how many, like 6 shorts? Yep. That are connected within the Zootopia franchise. And something I didn't quite get until watching them, they're supposedly taking place during the movie. And I kind of wish that they were just on their own, just like the lives and stories in Zootopia. Then, oh, we got to find some way to fit in where this takes place. Because like Hop on Board takes place during a little bit during the beginning of the movie when Judy goes to Zootopia, but also shows Nick and his cohort making those little popsicles.
Oh, yeah.
And then the real rodents of Little Rodentia takes place a little bit during the first chase with Judy and Duke. And then Duke takes place after he gets arrested. And then The Godfather of the Bride, it's like the only one that has no real connection to the overall movie of Zootopia.
And that's because it's mostly in flashback, which I think that's why it's probably my favorite of the bunch.
Yeah, well, first off, Maurice LaMarre is just killing it as Mr. Big. I love his character, even though the trope and parody of spoofing The Godfather is old. Maurice LaMarre makes it so entertaining. I love how he starts out the flashbacks with like, it was 19... it doesn't matter. Then there's So You Think You Can Prance, which takes place right before Judy and Nick crack down on the red herring situation of what's going on with the carnivores. And then Dinner Rush takes place a little bit before the punchline gag at the end of the movie, where Flash is driving super fast in a speedy car and such. Like I said, I wish these were just disconnected from the movie. Otherwise, they're very cute for what they are. I still think Baymax has the best little anthology stories of the character from the movie encountering other people within that world. But Zootopia has a lot of potential to have all these little side stories. There's just not much to them. I wish the real rodents of Little Rodentia went a little further with its parody of like the Real Housewives or Kardashians and such. It's like they have the base for all of the parodies and such, like all the best friends, the fake drama. I love that when it looks big and like violent from their angle, but then it zooms out to the polar bears, like watching them. So it's just like, it's so small, but you know, shrews are one of the most vicious animals in the animal kingdom. That's why the whole joke of Mr. Big being a shrew is so clever.
Duke, I did get a kick out of that.
Yeah. And Duke, the musical, like it's cute. It's sweet. It's got Alan Tudyk singing. They brought back actually like a majority of the main cast, except for like one or two because of just one line and such. They didn't bring back the guy who played the yak, voiced by Tommy Chong.
Oh, right.
The nudist guy. But that's because he was in it for like one line. But no, they brought back like Bonnie Hunt. They brought back Don Lake. They brought back Jennifer Goodwin and Jason Bateman. Idris Elba as Chief Bogo is back, and Nate Torrance as Benjamin Clawhauser. I think my favorites were The Godfather of the Bride and So You Think You Can Prance, because So You Think You Can Prance just basically reinforces everyone's like friendship with Bogo and Clawhauser. It's also just kind of fun to see Bogo go all out with the dance, I think, even though it turns out to be a dream.
I was like half expecting that to be the punchline just because things got so ridiculous during that competition. But I still found the whole short to be satisfying in its own right. My favorites are obviously The Godfather, The Bride, and Dinner Rush, just because I can kind of sympathize with the main character who just wants to go home, but is stuck with, like, the nightmare customers.
No, it's very funny because it's, I mean, now it's like, even though it was like the most overplayed part of the marketing, why Flash and the whole DMV that is employed by sloths is so funny because nobody likes going to the DMV. So what would be the worst thing about a DMV and then making it two times worse? And here it's just like, yeah, she wants to go to the Gazelle concert, and then it's Flash and his date, Priscilla. It's very cute. Like I said, there's not much to talk about with these shorts. They look good. I mean, there's definitely like not on the same exact level of Zootopia, but they're really close. You can definitely tell that they got their main animation teams that work at the film side of the studio working on here. I loved a few of the little details here and there, like when the waiter is like about to turn away, but then Priscilla talks, and then you could see her, the waiter, twist her body, and it's exactly like how you see an otter swim. So it's like, oh, that's a cool little touch. And also, it's just some of these characters are very funny. It was fun to see Stu and Bonnie actually be characters instead of just the overly protective and worried parents of the original film. I guess I'm still very impressed that they got all the big names back for basically redoing their lines half the time.
The last thing I have to say about this is the closest comparison I can make to these shorts is The Lion King 1.5, where it's like Timon and Pumbaa are kind of doing their own thing in like the margins of the main story. I feel like that had to have been at least a partial influence when making these shorts.
It will be interesting to see why they wanted to connect them all into the movie. I wish they went a little further with some of them. Like, I wanted to see a little more scathing and punching on the reality TV show side of things. I wanted to see a little bit more of everything. Because, you know, Disney kind of paints themselves in this circle of like, oh, we gotta not go too far or else we wouldn't be Disney. And it's like, well, why is that a bad thing? Why not, you know, try everything? Which was a big message of Zootopia.
Exactly.
But I'll say this, I'd rather watch these six shorts on a loop over the soccer football movie.
Oh boy.
Okay, so yeah, I'm going to just get this out of the way first. This movie came out of nowhere. I am usually very good and very aware of all the movies that are coming out every year, including everything that's going on around the other side of the world. This just showed up out of nowhere, and not in a good way. Netflix was barely marketing this movie. The trailer that it had was just a clip. It wasn't even like a fancy edited trailer. And there was no information about where the heck this thing was getting made. Who was making it? No press articles about it. I even went to the media website to see if I could get a screener just so I can get some details. They wouldn't even give you a contact. This is a dire situation of Netflix absolutely not wanting you to know this film exists. And yet, this is the exact kind of film that I know every animation YouTuber is going to have a field day with.
Yeah. It's definitely one of those.
Yeah. Oy. So this is directed by Mitch Doerr, who was the creator of the Angry Beavers cartoon. Yet another show I'd rather watch than this movie. It's written by Diki Deke, who, from what I could find, doesn't have too many credits outside of the Cuphead show. The one thing people have wanted to figure out, who was making this movie. Some people thought it was Vanguard Animation because Netflix and Vanguard are apparently very tight. But it wasn't Vanguard. It was our good friends at Splash Entertainment, the studio behind 2010's Alpha and Omega and 2016's infamous disaster of Norm of the North.
That explains everything.
Nothing against the people who are working there. I'm sure they are just not given anything to make these movies. I get it. I'm sorry that they are put into that situation. And this isn't aimed at anyone specifically who made the movie. There's literally no production history that I can find out about this movie. So if anyone hears this, whoever worked on this movie and wants to come onto the podcast to talk about it, I would be interested to know what happened. And I'm not in a mean or terrible kind of way that most clickbaity nonsense would be executed. I just want to know what happened. Mike, do you want to explain the plot?
I will do my best. When mysterious green slime monsters start popping out of soccer balls, all-star athletes Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Megan Rapinoe must team up with their four biggest fans to stop evil scientist Weird Al Yankovic, I swear I'm not making a word of this up, from stealing their talent.
What is Weird Al doing here? Right around the same time the biopic of his career comes out, Netflix is like, oh, we will release this because it has Weird Al in it. And listen, Weird Al is the only one putting in the effort in this movie. He is the only celebrity I can think of who is absolutely aware of what kind of film, show, or whatever he is in. Because otherwise, this movie is a disaster. Why does Weird Al not, and not just Weird Al playing a character, Weird Al want to be the best soccer player in the world? Why does it have to have these green slug things that turn Zlatan and Megan into creatures? What does this have to do with this weird little group of four kids who don't really have any personality to them that are like the discount Ghostbuster kids from that Ghostbusters Afterlife film from last year? There's nothing that really feels cohesive about this movie, and I am just trying my hardest to remember something about this movie.
All I remember is Zlatan saying his name, all like every other line, and the characters basically being cardboard cutouts of archetypes, and Weird Al just being Weird Al.
And it's like the weird thing about this, like finding out that this is directed by the guy who created Angry Beavers, reminds me why I liked that show and just how absurd it got, especially during the show's titular Halloween episode where they got to meet their favorite movie star. That episode is so funny and creative. And you could tell Mitch and Weird Al and everyone is trying to make this work, but there's nothing here. It was like they were told they had to make a movie and then good luck, because man, this is an ugly looking movie. I know some people are saying they look like Metaverse CGI figures. I think they look like Xbox Live avatars.
I call them a slapdash assortment of rejected Grubhub commercial character assets.
It's an ugly looking movie. Some of the worst CGI out there. That's saying something when we've had Marmaduke and that Ice Age direct-to-video film that came out on Disney Plus. I'm sorry. Like, I'm sure the two soccer stars that are connected to this film were pretty excited to do something a little different instead of just doing another sports drink deal or whatever. But man, the acting here is awful. The only ones who have been doing their best were Weird Al and then Tom Kenny just showing up out of nowhere. Outside of that, I don't think there's a good performance in here. At least with that Ice Age film, there's Simon Pegg. At least with Marmaduke, there's Pete Davidson and J.K. Simmons. Don't even ask me how the two in Marmaduke mix. Just, ugh. It's just not funny. The jokes don't land. And it's trying so hard to be absurd and goofy and cartoony.
And it just comes across kind of clumsy in execution.
Yeah, it's very clumsy. And for a soccer sports movie, it's not thrilling to watch because you know how it's going to end. Granted, the giant alien bug thing was kind of unexpected, but also it's only there for like 5 minutes before it gets killed. But other than that, it's a real waste of time. It's like the ideal example of an animated film animation haters point to that think everything since 2009 has been awful. I feel bad for the people who had to make this. Again, they probably weren't given a whole lot to work with, and sadly, it comes off up short. Even Weird Al, who I'm becoming more and more aware of, seems to either know how to elevate the dialogue or material given to him, or is one of those really funny people who is totally reliant on who's directing him to make it work.
It might be a little bit of both, because while nothing about his character in this movie makes sense, he kind of in his head knew that, so just kind of ran with it by being as completely unhinged as possible.
It's just the material he's given offers him nothing in return. You can see why Netflix wanted to bury this. In a year where they have like the Sea Beast and Wendell and Wild, My Father's Dragon, why would they want to waste time with this movie? They put out a few clips on the day it was released. This thing is going to get buried under the algorithm until a bunch of YouTubers come across it and be like, oh my gosh, I got material for my new episode. I can eat for another week. Don't watch it. Not even for a hate watch. A hate watch doesn't solve anything. Don't even torrent or pirate it. Avoid it.
This is like the one time I'll actually thank Netflix for being themselves.
Just bad writing, bad animation, bad characters, bad acting. Maybe someday Splash Entertainment will give us something that will be like, oh, hey, that was pretty decent.
Today is not that day. We need a palate cleanser, so let's go over to Cartoon Saloon with their second directorial effort from Noratomi. This is My Father's Dragon, based on the 1948 children's book of the same name by Ruth Stiles. And we follow Elmer, a kid who's having trouble adjusting to his new life, who decides to set out to find a wild island and rescue a young dragon. His adventures will lead him to encounter ferocious beasts, discover a mysterious place, and make a new friendship. I'm a bit jealous that you got to see this in a movie theater at Animation is Film. How was that?
Yeah, I was at Animation is Film when this premiered, and it was really cool. I got to see Jacob Tremblay there, and Chris O'Dowd, and Noratomi was there as well, along with the writer and I think composer. It was just a magical experience to see a Cartoon Saloon on the big screen. If you can see their films on the big screen, do so. Unfortunately, when Netflix says a theatrical release, unless it's something like that Glass Onion movie, they will not give a wider release than New York and California. So that's very disappointing. But I was fortunate enough to see it at Animation is Film, one of the few films playing there that sold out. It was an event that came full circle because Animation is Film, that started in 2017, and that's when Noratomi had the breadwinner. So then to see My Father's Dragon come back to Animation is Film and also take home one of the major awards, you can tell that the animation world loves Cartoon Saloon and the people that work there. And who could blame them? They make great movies. But let's talk about the one thing that will make this extremely noticeable to people who are huge fans of their films.
The fact that this is a primarily American cast?
Well, it's got a more Western U.S. sensibilities to its story execution and outcome. The mostly English cast is also really interesting. Not that Cartoon Saloon has never had celebrity voice casts. Brendan Gleeson was in The Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea, and Wolfwalkers had Sean Bean in it. But to see a cast so filled to the brim with recognizable faces was very different than what they usually have going for them. I don't think that hurts the film in any way just because it has a more stacked cast. I mean, we have Jacob Tremblay, Gaten Matarazzo, Golshifteh Farahani, Diane Wiest, Rita Moreno, Chris O'Dowd, Judy Greer, Alan Cumming, Yara Shahidi, Jackie Earl Haley, Mary Kay Place, Charlene Yee, Adam Brody, Whoopi Goldberg, and Ian McShane. And they do a good job. Like, Jacob Tremblay is a super talented actor. And it was good to see Gaten be given a much different kind of character to play. Because most people, of course, would know him from his run on Stranger Things. But it was nice to see him in a different environment. And from what I remember hearing from animationist film, Jacob would talk about how they would improv with one another, which makes sense. And it's why their chemistry works so well together, because they were able to bounce off of one another very well.
Just natural chemistry is something that you can't fake chemistry like that. And that's what really helps their friendship in the film feel believable. And I think that's honestly the best thing about this movie.
And just because we're saying like this has more Western sensibilities, this does not mean that it's more in tone with like an old DreamWorks movie or something like that. The humor is still very universal and wide and casts a wide net of what kind of jokes and dialogue that you'll hear. There is one joke that I was kind of on, but it was cute. But that's best because they were both able to pull it off well. But they were also very funny together. Like when Elmer and Boris were like, where Elmer got stuck in a pit trap. And Boris is just like, your shirt, your pants, your backpack and everything. And Elmer's like, yeah, I could tie it like a rope. Okay, yeah, let's do your idea. What were you wanting to do? No, let's just do your idea. And it's definitely a more family-friendly, approachable movie compared to some of the other Cartoon Saloon films that can get very dark. I think that's not a detracting point from it.
Not at all.
It might cast a wider net than other audience ranges from their previous films. Anyone can still watch this and I think get a huge kick out of it. It's still well written. It's atmospheric. It's got that beautiful Cartoon Saloon art style that is just so good looking. It's also like a very complex film still. It's all about, it's a coming of age story that's all about facing your fears, not being afraid in a world of uncertainty. But it's also not saying you can never be afraid, because being afraid means you are alive.
I think that's the thing that I took away from this the most, that people always say, like, face your fears, but acknowledging that you are afraid and that you don't have all the right answers is kind of an important first step to any sort of character growth. And I really like the way that they tackled it here. The only thing I didn't like, and, you know, this is a thing I've gone on for, you know, forever, is there is that point just before the third act where Elmer and Boris kind of go their separate ways. But fortunately, they don't dwell on that for too long. That's really the only real negative I have in a movie that I otherwise thoroughly enjoyed.
Yeah, because it's a movie where it's really like Elmer is trying to overcome the challenges that are put upon by him and his mother, who are struggling to make a living in a, I'm going to assume, 1920s or 30s time period of like the Great Recession. and such.
It sounds like Nevergreen is like supposed to be a stand-in for New York or any major metropolis.
As he traverses this wild island and such and encounters all the animals, you find out that the animals, like, yes, there are some more antagonistic characters, like Chris O'Dowd's character. But with someone like Ian McShane's character, Sewa, he's just trying to help the people by using temporary solutions to something that needs a long-term fix. And I like Ian McShane as Sewa. I think he's a very good sort of imposing, like, challenge that the characters have to get past. But it takes a Ghibli approach to how there's no quote-unquote real bad people, because they're all on the same boat, well, the same island.
If anything, the antagonist is, I guess you could say, the island, but also just the general concept of the unknown. There may be like fighting amongst the animals. They all have the same goal. They just want to be safe.
And it flows very well. And I do like how it balances out its morals and themes and how it commentates on itself. It reminds me of that one line from The Good Dinosaur that Sam Elliott's character says. You can't get rid of fear. It's like Mother Nature. You can't beat her or outrun her, but you can get through it. And that's all that this movie is, because Elmer wants to use Boris for his own needs, but he realizes that he doesn't need Boris for his needs. He needs to say, like, hey, things are going to get tough. It's okay to be afraid. You can get through it. I just think that's really cool. It's still a Cartoon Saloon movie, so there's definitely nuance and different little details and elements that you can pick apart and such if you want to dive deep into its story and writing. Even if maybe this is one of the more simpler approached stories that they've crafted, which, again, not a bad thing. Not every film needs to be a heady, complex mind puzzle. And it has some genuinely sweet moments. I love when Elmer and Boris are sitting on top of the flower.
That was a nice scene.
And it's just a good movie. You can see why it won one of the major awards that animation is film, and not just because people love Nora and she was there and what have you. It's a good story, it's good writing, and it's just a wonderful, charming, magical experience that I think more people need to check out, because for some reason, once again, Netflix spent all this money on a movie for Cartoon Saloon only to not advertise it.
Yeah, Netflix, unless you're going to start paying us, we can't be your P&A department.
You cannot rely on the algorithm and word of mouth for everything. It's so tiring seeing all these great movies and great shows come out on your service, and yet you don't spend a dime on marketing. Even if there's award potential, because Netflix has like 5 really good movies that they could market for award season this year. People should vote for this one because it is Cartoon Saloon, and Cartoon Saloon has been nominated multiple times over. But if nobody knows that this film came out, then what's the point? I don't know. It's just so frustrating.
I'm just looking at the credits, and one of them is a producer named Bonnie Curtis, who has worked on a bunch of Steven Spielberg's movies. And yeah, this definitely feels like Cartoon Saloon animating a classic Amblin movie from the 80s and 90s. And if that sounds appealing to you, then you should definitely give this a watch.
Oh, that makes so much sense that the producer worked on Spielberg movies. Because yeah, this one has a very big Spielberg vibe to it, which makes me hope that one day Spielberg will go back to animation and such. Go see this movie. Netflix could easily wipe the floor with award nominations this year if they play their cards right, because it's kind of wild how they've had a stack of really good movies pretty much almost every month of this year.
It's really just insane how lucky they've gotten.
I wish they were giving them the same support that other studios would be doing. Other studios and companies would be making sure you knew about it. They'd be playing TV ads or ads online or in the movie theater. Hopefully in the future or something, maybe G-Kids teams up with Netflix to release it on Blu-ray. I would like to own this on Blu-ray. There is an art book coming out, and I'm thinking about picking that up. But now, let's jump into the one time that we will, for right now, talk about One Piece. Because we have to check out and discuss One Piece film Red. So, Mike, this is your first time jumping into One Piece, one of the most daunting franchises ever. Because, you know, it's only got like 1,000+ episodes. I don't see the problem with that.
A little bit of background for my history with One Piece. So I used to collect the monthly Shonen Jump magazines back in like the early 2000s. And this was when Shonen Jump printed in America for a few years. So that was like first started getting into the One Piece manga, but never really followed it all the way through. Then 4Kids did their hack in the mid-2000s, and I'm pretty sure that turned a lot of Western audiences off. The last time I really saw anything of the anime was just like a couple random episodes of the Funimation dub on Toonami. And then because by that point, the anime was in like the 300s episodes, it just kind of felt too overwhelming to jump on from the beginning. Up until now, I have still not experienced a full arc of the series, but given the pomp and circumstance surrounding Film Red, this being sort of their celebration of the manga's 25th anniversary, I had to check this one out because they made a pretty big deal out of this one.
It makes you wonder what would have happened with One Piece if it didn't get that disastrous 4Kids deal. Listen, I love the One Piece rap as much as everyone else does because it was like one of the few actually good openings that 4Kids did for their shows. I mean, come on, man. Even if the 4Kids deal just ruined the show by cutting out multiple story arcs and edited around a show that was not really meant for kids in a US and traditional sense, you know, not made for kids because it's violence and it could get extremely dark really fast if you watch the uncut version and such.
Oh, yeah.
But that rap song is a bop. But it makes you wonder, like, when One Piece came out, if Funimation got it in the first place, if One Piece would have gone as big as, like, Dragon Ball did or Gundam, if it didn't get the chop job from 4Kids and such. Even like 4Kids was not, from what I remember reading and watching videos of, was actually not all that wanting to distribute One Piece, but they had to because of, I think, a deal they made with Toei. But there are plenty of stories and articles and videos that talk about that.
Just to answer your question, had Funimation got this like from the jump, this would 100% be as big, if not bigger, than Dragon Ball and Yu Yu Hakusho at the time. Considering how popular this anime and manga were in Japan, all it would have taken was just a little push further in the West. This would have taken off like hotcakes.
It's the anime franchise in Japan. I mean, yeah, there's, you know, Jujutsu Kaisen, Naruto, and other franchises like the currently running Chainsaw Man and such, and Demon Slayer and what have you. But One Piece is like the mountaintop of popular anime. There was already going to be a lot that they'd have to deal with. Like, it took a little bit after 4Kids dumped One Piece. Like, you should see what the final episode was when they finally said, okay, we're done. It ends on such a horrible, hilarious note. It's like one of those, let's just say, put it in context here. It's like when you watch a movie that thinks it's going to get a sequel, but it doesn't.
Oh, okay. So it's one of those.
Or like a show that thinks it's going to get a second season, but doesn't. So it ends on like an unintentionally horrible place. Kind of like how The Prince last year ended on the fact that the entire royal family was about to get murdered. So let's talk about this. This is the newest film that's doing truly gangbuster profits for an anime film in the US. It even beat out, I think for one day, it beat out Black Adam. And of course, now it's going to get trampled by Black Panther Wakanda Forever, which, you know, I get it. But this new movie is directed by Gorō Taniguchi. It's written by Tsutomu Kuroiwa and is animated by Toei. So with this movie, we join our favorite pirate crew, the Straw Hat Pirates, as they stop by an island called Elysia. And they're there to partake and enjoy a concert from the biggest idol, the biggest pop star in the world of One Piece, named Uta, who in the English dub is voiced by Amanda Lee.
Perfect casting, by the way.
Yeah, she's great. After a really good opening number. Seriously, this movie has a fantastic pop idol soundtrack. And it's even like veers into like different genres of music at one point. On the soundtrack alone, you should definitely go see this movie. What happens is a bunch of pirates try to kidnap Uta. Then, of course, Luffy and the Straw Hat Pirates intervene and save the day. And it turns out that Luffy actually knows Uta from long ago when they were kids, because Uta is the daughter of Shanks, the infamous leader of the Red Hair Pirates, who are Luffy's inspiration and possible end goal of who he has to face in the end. Though knowing Blackbeard and his crew getting stronger by the day, we will have to see. This whole movie then turns into like Uta telling the Straw Hats and everyone like, "I'm so glad you are here. You are all my fans. I love you. And now we're going to be in a world where it's nothing but happiness, no pain, no sadness. And I'm going to make sure y'all are there with me." Which makes everyone go, "Wait, what?" It goes from pop idol sensation to cult leader.
Basically.
Basically telling everyone to listen to a musical version of the Red Punch at the table over there. So it's up to Luffy, a couple of different pirate characters, and the Straw Hat crew, and with some help from Shanks and the Red Hair Pirates, to save the day and to stop Uta from stealing everyone's souls. The one reason outside of the incredible soundtrack to see this movie is for Uta herself. I think she is one of this franchise's best villains.
I'm not even sure I feel comfortable calling her a villain. We'll get to why in a second, but
she's a villain in the sense that she is the one causing a major threat to the world.
Sure.
It's that Killmonger kind of way of villainy where she's like, "I hate that this world is full of pain and people are suffering, so I'm going to make sure that they live in a world where it doesn't." What, like, where the pain and suffering is nowhere to be found.
And I think that's why I like her character so much, because, yeah, her goals are, she has good intentions, but what she's doing is actually causing more harm than good.
And there are definitely some moments where Uta kind of turns the, "I'm the bubbly idol," to, "I just want everyone to be happy forever and ever." And it's like, okay, I'm going to call the police, or in this case, the Navy. We're going to lock you up so you don't hurt me. She is a compelling character. You find out that she's the daughter, quote unquote, of Shanks. As you go through the movie, you find out the tragic history of why she was on this island and why she feels such a hatred for pirates and for people who cause pain in the world. It's a film that tackles stuff like strained relationships and abandonment and how, like, yes, the world in One Piece sucks. Like, One Piece has one of the most complex world building sets of lore. And there are some truly heinous characters who will make everyone suffer. Like, there was this one character that shows up that Uta takes care of easily, who is just like, "I want to buy you and make you my personal idol that I can listen to at all times." I think you'll know who I'm talking about. And then when like his two goons do not succeed in capturing her. He just shoots them. Let's just say, Mike, that whenever you get to that part of the story arc in the show, you are going to hate that character, despite the fact that in the movie he's played up more of like pathetic as he truly is.
Oh, so he's 10 times as despicable in the series? Figured as much.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. Like a lot of franchise shonen films, there's no real timeline or continuity of when this exactly takes place, because it also doesn't quite add up, especially with some of the details. Like Jinbei, the shark or stingray character, like he's supposed to join the crew recently. So that means it's between the arc where they take on the big mama pirates, either before or during the Wano arc, which just wrapped up. By the way, that arc took 4 years to make.
Wow.
It's supposed to maybe take place there, but there are some like details that don't quite add up, because like Luffy goes into another like of his forms with his gum fruit, and it's like, oh, so he gains this during the Wano arc. So if this is supposed to take place after that, then there needs to also be another character. So this takes place after the story arc with the Big Mama Pirate. Well, no, because then
Jinbei
would not be there. So it's like, if you try to piece it together, it doesn't quite work. What complicates things further is that Oda is an executive producer on here and helped craft a story and such. He's made some parts canon, like this is Shanks' daughter, and Luffy and her know each other. But everything else is just kind of up in the air. Like, I shouldn't care. Not everything needs to be connected. But with so many franchise films these days that come out, and the show constantly or consistently acknowledges their existence, then it's kind of crummy that some franchise films are still sticking to the, we don't really need to connect to the main continuity, even though they introduce things that would be really important in the long run of the world of One Piece, but, you know, whatever.
It does kind of feel like some franchises need just pick a lane. Like, credit where credit is due to the Dragon Ball franchise. Ever since Battle of Gods, they've made it clear that all of the movies now are canon, which is good, because that sort of consistency will help in the long run.
And like, yes, other franchise films have found ways to make it work. Like Jujutsu Kaisen Zero is a prequel, an actual prequel story to the mangas, so it makes sense that they turn it into a movie and it connects to the show. And then Demon Slayer Mugen Train is an actual arc from the show that the show then redoes and expands upon a little. Like, for all, like, of the shonen franchise film shenanigans, I think, like, as much as, like, I've been annoyed with them, and they're in this movie, Uta is the reason why the movie works.
100%. I can only speak for myself, but as someone who's not really as immersed in the One Piece universe, there's a lot of nuances from all the various arcs that I haven't picked up on, but for the stuff that matters, like the relationship between Uta, Luffy, and Shanks, that's the stuff I was focusing on, and that's the stuff that the movie actually succeeds in getting me invested in. Whereas, like, with the stuff that I don't know, it's not like I'm demanding answers, but more like asking questions like, I want to know more about what's going on with these characters, or, ooh, I can't wait to see more adventures with the other members of the Straw Hat crew.
I mean, that's the thing. You'll have plenty to catch up on. You got 1,000+ episodes to watch.
I do plan to just, on my own time, go through the entire series. And maybe once in a while, I'll use the recommendation segment to, you know, update you guys on my progress. But
I'm right now heading into the time period of when the 2-year time skip starts. I'm not there yet. I am at the point where the official The Worst Generation all show up. So for One Piece fans, you'll know exactly where I am.
Getting back to the movie, I think animation-wise, seeing this on the big screen was a trip.
I'm sure this looked amazing on a big screen. I didn't have time to go see it on the big screen, but I was thankfully given a screener for it. This was also extremely sold out at Animation as Film when it showed up there.
No surprise there.
Oh gosh, it's One Piece. I think with the success of stuff like Mugen Train and Jujutsu Kaisen Zero and the My Hero Academia films, it's nice to see that the One Piece films are starting to pick up the pace of becoming more and more well known. Like, a majority of this film does focus on Luffy and Uta, even though a lot of this film's marketing was like, oh, we'll get to see Shanks and the red hair pirates. Even though they don't play too big of a role until maybe the last 40 minutes.
That's when they kind of come in to really help the two dimensions. Both they come in to help the people who are asleep in the real world. Well, pretty much coordinating in a pretty cool way, by the way, with Usopp and his dad sort of teaming up between the two dimensions.
It's really cool how they set this all up. And the thing with a lot of franchise films is that sometimes they can feel like padded out 3-episode arcs. To a degree, it almost comes off like that because Luffy gets separated from the Straw Hats, and the Straw Hats get stuck with having to team up with two members of the Big Mama Pirates. And Luffy is stuck with some other fan favorite characters. And it's all about like finding out the mystery of the island and Uta's backstory, which we find out that Uta hates Shanks because she thought that he abandoned her and like caused all this destruction on the island. When we find out that when Uta was young, she found these sacred musical papers that summoned a very powerful demon, caused all this chaos and such, and Shanks was able to save the day, but he felt like Uta needed to be here. Her music was too powerful for her to stay on the ship that they have, and so he just lied to her, to this one side character who doesn't really have a whole lot to do in the movie itself, but it's like the caretaker and mentor to Uta's character.
You're talking about Gordon?
Gordon, who's voiced by Jim Ferronda, doesn't have a whole lot to do in the story. He's just kind of there like, please don't do this, Uta. You know that you shouldn't. And then almost dies like a couple different times. The Straw Hats are all basically trying to find out the lore and the history of the island and such. It's kind of padded out stuff, but it's handled pretty well. At least it keeps adding on to the plot, so it doesn't feel like it's just wasting everyone else's time because they needed the other characters to do something. And that happens sometimes. That's why a lot of these franchise films make enough bad guys for everyone to fight, because it gives the characters something to do.
And to be fair, everyone, when they do have their moment, it is really cool to see them all in action.
Yeah, it is very cool. They at least do give them all something to do. And what helps is that the voice cast is great. Monkey D. Luffy is voiced by Colleen Clickenbeard, who is great. You know, we've already said Uta is voiced by Amanda Lee. She's good. Brandon Potter is the MVP of Shanks, because Shanks is just such a cool character, and there's just nuance to him that the show definitely expands upon better. But it's also good to hear people like Christopher Sabat as Zoro, Lucy Christian as Nami, Sonny Strait as Usopp, Eric Vale as Sanji, Brianna Palencia as Tony Choppa, Stephanie Young as Nico Robin, one of my favorites, Patrick Seitz as Frankie, Ian Sinclair as Brook, Daniel Ball as Jinbei, Jim Ferronda as Gordon, we have Mika Solusad as Cody, Mike McFarland as Hell Meppo, and then Trafalgar Law, who's voiced by Matthew Mercer. And then we have like Chris George, we have Tyson Reinhardt, Sean Hennigan, John Bergenmeyer, Jeff Johnson, Josh Grell, Josh Martin, J. Paul Slavens, Rico Ferraldo, Andrew Love, Ray Hurd, Aaron Roberts, Charles Campbell, Ken Williams, Mac Ficker, Jason Marnoka, Jonah Scott, Rachel Robinson, and Lisa Ortiz as the little Sunny character, with some other appearances by Shelley Colleen Black, Orion Pitts, and Dallas Reed. Such a huge cast, and it's just like all the characters who have been there from in One Piece at one point, like Bluno was a CP9 agent, Charlotte Oven and Charlotte Brûlée are Big Mama Pirate members, along with Charlotte Katakuri. Fujitora is a very important general in the Navy. Akainu Sakazuki, the guy with the Hawaiian shirt, and he was just like, you know, we could just blow the whole island up if we wanted to. And Kizaru / Borsalino is just the most chill dude. It's a celebration of just like bringing a lot of fan favorite characters in one space. So it doesn't really matter. It's like, why the hell are you here? You could just argue and give the excuse of, oh, they're all fans of Uta. I'm fine with that.
As a celebration film, I think this succeeds. The reason why you put movies like this in theaters is, yeah, obviously the One Piece fans are like going to flock to it opening night, but movie studios don't necessarily gatekeep any of these. Like, any random schmoke can walk into a movie like this at their own risk, mind you. But if a movie like this can get like a casual viewer like myself on board with the series, then it's doing something right.
It's like a double-edged sword. You could alienate people, but then that alienation could be like, well, now I gotta watch the show. And then you get another fan for life if they can tolerate going through 1,000+ episodes. Which, to be fair, a lot of those are specials and filler arcs that are not canon to the main timeline. So you can skip about a good chunk of them. So it's not technically 1,000 episodes. It's still a lot, though.
Yeah.
That's why there are like 3 different One Piece villains, from movies to a filler arc, that all have the same heat-based powers that Charlotte Oven has. But Charlotte Oven is the only one who gets the canon heat-based power. And yeah, the action is really bombastic and stylized. I mean, this is a world where things called devil fruits play a big role in the power structures. And that's why Uta is so powerful, because she ate the Sing Sing fruit, which makes people fall in love with her music, and then they get trapped in her own little music world. It's so scary to hear that it's like, oh, if Uta dies, then all the souls that are stuck in there are stuck. Oy, okay. And that's why she's a major threat, and why the Sing Sing fruit, which sounds silly, is actually a really big deal.
It definitely feels like they made a really big deal of that in the movie.
And there are some elements of CGI fused within it, and it kind of had to, with especially the big bad demon that shows up at the end. But it's handled well. It's maybe not like Studio Orange or Dragon Ball Super superhero level of amazing, but it doesn't look out of place.
Anytime it did feel a bit off, I always just kind of wrote it off as like, oh, well, they're in this fantasy world, so of course it's going to look a little abnormal.
It's not that distracting. And I know this film already made like a stupid amount of money, but yeah, go see it if you are interested or are curious about it. It might not be the most friendliest shonen franchise film to jump into, because, you know, you have 25 years of story and such to get through, but, you know, why not take the jump?
Yeah, if you like what you see, it will inspire you to dive deeper.
Plus, I'm sure there are guides and videos of like, here's where you can watch, here's where you can skip, and rundowns of like the whole story up to this point. Want to know the connection with all the characters and such.
A great YouTuber that I'll recommend is Grandline Review, who basically has an entire channel devoted strictly to One Piece.
Saw that video and it was really solid how he was able to sum it all up in 20 minutes, when he's definitely like truncating to the most important story beats that happen.
Definitely not an easy feat.
No, it's not, especially with how many twists and turns the franchise takes. But yeah, anyway, it's been a good year for anime franchise films. I'm glad that they are becoming more available to watch in theater. I hope the people that go see these movies also go to see the non-franchise stuff as well. And hopefully sooner or later, all the money that these films are making go towards the voice actors as well, who bring these characters to life for the U.S. audiences. Because, you know, we're going through that a bit of a fiasco right now with voice actors in anime needing to be given more money and credit and not to be screwed around by companies like Crunchyroll and such.
And now we return to the Ghibli journey, which it's been a while since we've done one of these, but we are finally talking about, is it your number one or like top five?
It's top three.
Top three. Okay. We are talking about 1992's Porco Rosso.
Yeah, I've talked about this before. My three favorite Ghibli films were Castle in the Sky, Porco Rosso, and Spirited Away. It's been nice to really like now get to this one because like you can catch me on a different day and I'll say, oh, it's Castle in the Sky or it's Spirited Away. But there's just something about Porco Rosso that keeps me coming back to it time and time again. It's probably the one I've rewatched the most outside of Castle in the Sky. Yeah, it's just one of my favorite movies ever.
Now that I've seen this, I know exactly why this movie is as beloved as it is. If nothing else, it's just a really fun adventure.
Yeah, so Porco Rosso, known in Japan as Crimson Pig or Kurenai no Buta, is the sixth animated film by Miyazaki. And you're introduced to an Italian World War I fighter ace, now living as a freelance bounty hunter chasing air pirates in the Adriatic Sea. He has been given a curse that changed his head to that of a pig. Once called Marco Pago, he is now known to the world as Porco Rosso, Italian for red pig. Essentially what happens is that one day after taking down the air pirates, the pirates started to band together to get a pilot who could take down Porco, who is this American pilot named Curtis. We'll talk about who he's voiced by in a moment, because I think the casting for this movie is really good and really interesting. Donald Curtis, an American pilot, takes down Porco one evening, and luckily for Porco, he survives, but his plane is thrashed, just destroyed. So he takes it to Italy to get it repaired by Mr. Piccolo, voiced by the late, great David Ogden Stiers, who this is like, I think our third or fourth time that we've talked about a Ghibli film where he shows up.
Yep, I think so.
And he encounters his young girl, Vio, voiced by Kimberly Williams Paisley. Basically, Porco wants a rematch with Curtis. So he gets the plane fixed and it then turns into a battle of pretty much pride between Porco and Curtis. What I like about this movie is how old school it feels. Like, it's not like a high octane action adventure film. It's more of a drama. It reminds me of a lot of films from like the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, it definitely has that kind of old Hollywood aesthetic, not just in the actual setting where it takes place, but even in the details like Joe Hisaishi's score, the performances from the English cast, which seriously, how Disney at the time had a really good mix of on-screen actors, but also some of the best voice act in the business. It all just works perfectly.
It really does. Not to say that there's no action, because like the flying in this movie is great. Once again, it's Miyazaki partaking in one of his favorite things, which is airplanes and flight. But all the characters are really likable, even the ones who are meant to be the antagonists. Like Donald Curtis is extremely smug and up his own, you know what. But he's so fun, like as an antagonist against Porco. And he's not even like a terrible person. I mean, like he has his own level of pride and honor. But he's also like wants to not be outshined by Porco. Did you know that at first that Donald Curtis was voiced by Cary Elwes?
I didn't recognize him like at first, but the more I started to hear the performance, the more it really made sense. Oh, yeah, of course Cary Elwes would voice a pompous American hotshot.
It's just interesting because the last time we talked about Cary Elwes, he was in The Cat Returns and Whisper of the Heart, where he was more like his typical, charming, fantastical British self. But with Donald Curtis, he plays an entirely different character. And I love that he's doing something different. Curtis has a lot of just great moments. But that's not to say that the rest of the voice cast is bad either, because for Porco, we have Michael Keaton. And for one of Michael Keaton's first voiceover roles, he does a great job.
He really does.
I mean, it just shows that he's a good character and such. It's not like, this isn't like the first time he's done voice work. He was in King of the Hill. He was in The Simpsons. He was in Cars around the same time when Porco came out. Well, when Porco was brought to the U.S. I mean. And then, of course, Toy Story. And then he's also in the Despicable Me films. But he brings this aged, withered, kind of tired, slightly cynical, slightly defeatist portrayal of a character who's really just kind of sick of the world that he's in because of losing his friends to war. Once again, if you're one of those people who doesn't like politics in their movies, too bad. This is all like post-World War One, anti-fascist, anti-nationalist themes and commentary, because Porco is just like, anytime someone comes up to him and says like, why don't you buy some war bonds to help our nation? And it's like, yeah, no. Or one of my favorite scenes and probably my favorite line of the movie when he goes get his gun and his ammo. And the kid there talks to the gunsmith, asks him, what's the difference between making money off of war and bounty hunting? The guy goes, if you make money off of war, you're scum. But if you can't make money off of bounty hunting, you're an idiot.
The dialogue in this is great. The other iconic line is in the movie theater where Ferrari comes in and says, like, you shouldn't be here, but I'm also mad that you left the Air Force. And he retorts with, I'd rather be a pig than a fascist.
There are so many great lines in this movie. I love the Mama Ayudo gang and all their cohorts. Well, first of all, the leader is voiced by Brad Garrett, who does a great job being this perfectly comedic foil for the movie, who's, once again, not a 100% good person, but also not the worst person out there. Like, the real villains of the film are basically nationalist and fascist governments. Funny to hear all of the political discourse around in this movie show up and such, and it brings like so much life to the film. And then another iconic sequence is when Porco first goes to the Hotel Adriatic to see Madame Gina, who's voiced by Susan Egan, aka Megara from Hercules.
I thought I recognized her.
Oh, yeah. Now, once you spot her, her voice is 100% identifiable in every other occasion. I love their chemistry and the romance between the two. One thing that has bugged me about this movie is not the movie itself, but how certain people have read the movie. Mostly getting hung up on the fact of why is Porco a pig. One, if you are one of those people, you lack imagination and need to be quiet. Two, Miyazaki liked pigs. Three, it's symbolic. He's a character who just would rather wallow in his own depression than be human. And he doesn't see himself as human anymore. So, and of course, as we see throughout the film, the pig side of him turns off maybe once or twice during the movie.
I think Theo's one of those people who kind of notices for like a split second while she's trying to sleep.
He's going through the ammo and she looks up and sees him in his human form. She's like, Porco? And then he turns to her and he's back in his pig form. And so many people get hung up on the fact that he's a pig. I remember one review being like, why can't he be something else or something more creative? And it's like, buddy, you are missing the point of this movie by getting hung up on the fact that he's a pig. Think for a second. Media literacy is so dead because of some of those reviews that get hung up on this issue. It's not even an issue. It's a non-issue.
There's a great Grant Morrison quote where he basically, just to paraphrase, says, like, adults have the most trouble when it comes to fiction because they get hung up on all these details. Whereas kids can just believe anything because they know it's not real.
It's so true. Like, golly. It's just amazing how easy it is to just slip into this movie and not be bothered by it. So it just sounds like people are trying way too hard to try to be smarter than Miyazaki at trying to figure out why Porco's a pig when it's pretty symbolic and pretty obvious, and also just kind of like, hey, Miyazaki likes pigs. Okay, because pigs are kind of stubborn and lazy, and Porco is very lazy. I love the first time you meet him. He's listening to the radio, and he gets a phone call, and the guy says, like, Porco, you got to help us. The Mama Ayudo gang is robbing us. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. As you can tell, I'm pretty busy right now. They're stealing our gold. And 15 schoolgirls.
Don't price gouge me. This is part of your contract.
Like I said, the Mama Ayudo gang is so delightful. And it's not just Brad Garrett. You can hear Bill Fagerbach, you know, who you would know as Patrick Starr. Yeah. And Kevin Michael Richardson, using a more nasally voice than like the deep voice that he likes to use for characters. And then, of course, Frank Welker shows up. And other voice actors include like Tom Kenny, who shows up also.
There's Tom Kenny, D. Bradley Baker, Jeff Bennett. I believe you can hear Rob Paulsen in there somewhere. Yep. Bill Farmer.
It's easy to spot them if you know who to look for.
Also, I believe it's Tress McNeil as one of the radio announcers.
Yes, and as Mr. Piccolo says, and the three old hags. There's such a whimsy and fantasy side to this movie that's really dark if you just take a moment to like think about it, just the whole war aspect and how many people have lost and like have lost loved ones and how nationalistic countries can get because, yeah, it was that time period. And just the visual imagery that you see in there. If you can't tell this film is anti-war, that's on you, buddy.
The fact that this has a very strong political undertones, but also can be just like a fun romp of comedic, bumbling antagonists like the Sea Pirates and even Mr. Piccolo's, his workshop where all of his sons are off in the war, trying to find work. So basically his entire crew is all of the women of the family, which was an interesting choice, but again, sense with the time period.
If you looked at stuff like, what was it? What's that Gina Davis sports movie with Tom Hanks in it?
A League of Their Own.
When the men were not to be found, the women had to partake in some other jobs that the men had to do. So it's not that out of place. It makes sense within the world. What I like about this movie is that it balances out like its anti-war message and its story better than most of his movies. I think it's a little more perfect than others. Like, I think The Wind Rises focuses more on the drama. And then I think something like Howl's Moving Castle, which we'll get to at one point, focused too much on the war aspect when everyone else loves the characters of that movie. But we'll get to that when we get to that.
I think this has the perfect balance between the drama and the comedy. And nothing feels necessarily out of place. It feels like you're in this time period. Like, all the characters feel real. You can kind of feel their each character's unique history throughout the film. It's just wonderful.
There's a reason why this is, like, my favorite Miyazaki movie. Just rewatching it again today before we recorded this has made me just lean back, sink into my chair, and just fall in love with this movie all over again. I wish it was better known among Miyazaki's films. It seems like this one gets kind of overshadowed by the likes of Castle in the Sky and Spirited Away and, of course, Princess Mononoke. But I feel like it deserves to be up there with the ones that people consider his best.
I agree with that. It does kind of feel like a B-side compared to some of the heavier hitters, but I personally have this basically tied for first with Castle in the Sky.
But now it's time to spin the wheel. All right, here we go. Well, I hope you like magic and war because we are going to embark on the second Studio Ghibli film to be nominated for an Oscar, Howl's Moving Castle.
Ooh, I know some people who are really going to be excited to hear that I'm watching this for the first time.
And I'm sorry to the people who are waiting for us to get the Princess Mononoke.
We will get there eventually.
Don't blame us, blame the wheel. But I think that wraps up for this episode. This is a long one. I could do a recommendation, but I'll save it for another time.
The only recommendation I had would have been for The Breadwinner. I wish that movie was still on Netflix, but you'll have to find that somewhere on the digital platforms.
Well, it's also readily available on Blu-ray and such, so you should be able to buy it for a good price. So,
oh yeah, but definitely do that because it's great.
The plan is we're going to talk about adult animation. And that's mostly going to revolve around talking about Inside Job in a more in-depth way and talking about FX's really good adult animated comedy, Little Demon. That's what's going to happen for next time.
I'm looking forward to that. But until then, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at CamsEyeView. I have my own website called CamsEyeView.biz. where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I have a Patreon at patreon.com/CamsEyeView. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on Twitter at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and Twitter at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser, on the Banana Meter. Listen to all of our podcasts on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. And last but not least, everything can be found at RenegadePopCulture.com. Need to escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.